Keeneland Life's Work Project, number 2, John Phillips, Derby Down Farm. His grandfather's greatest achievements on the turf were all about looking outwards, about opening minds and dismantling boundaries. Listening to John Phillips, however, you realise that the impetus for the whole adventure, for the mutual enlightenment either side of the ocean, achieved by sending Roberto and Rebo in opposite directions, could not have been more definitively American. Because, as Phillips says himself, the story of John Galbraith might have been written by Horatio Alger. A kid raised in a large, poor family in the Ohio backcountry, whose dynamism and imagination generated a fortune from the steepling transformations of post-war real estate. Happily, as it is, the man charged with sustaining Galbraith's legacy at the storied Derby Down Farm proves no mean Alger himself, as reflective as he is eloquent.
He was very proud of being an American. The notion of rugged individualism. And if you sort of studied the connections of his families, with his family, with his uncles and his father's father and the like, classic Americans going all over the country, making fortunes, losing fortunes, very sort of entrepreneurial, go-for-it attitude. He was never afraid of failure. Some things did fail for him, but he never looked back.
Sure enough, Galbraith was equally at home with all ranks of society, from farmers in their fields to the boardroom. And it was his faith in American values that prompted him to hire Branch Rickey, the man who brought Jackie Robinson to Major League Baseball, to run his Pittsburgh Pirates.
Grandfather felt that United States needs to be a meritocracy in everything we did, including sports. Although Branch Rickey was past his prime at that time, it did set the tone for the Pittsburgh Pirates. And so the Pittsburgh Pirates ended up recruiting, if you will, a lot of minority players. And they had a tremendous amount of talent.
One of these, in the rookie draft of 1954, was an African-American from Puerto Rico with very little English, Roberto Clemente. Through the turbulent years of the civil rights movement, Clemente's Hall of Fame career became a powerful symbol for Galbraith.
The relationship really took a decade to develop because there was huge cultural gaps there between a farmer in Ohio and somebody born and raised in Puerto Rico. Nonetheless, it was a relationship that was cemented. So when Roberto Clemente became a close friend, also, he was not just a friend, but he was a brilliant baseball player. Very sensitive, very committed human being.
In 1970, Galbraith decided to name the most athletic of his yearlings, a Hail to Reason colt, for Clemente. And it was the equine Roberto that farm manager Olin Gentry picked out as the most eligible to be sent on a pioneering mission to Vincent O'Brien in Ireland.
Off he went, with a ridiculous notion that some American just pick out one horse and go off to Europe and actually win the English Derby, but that was grandfather.
Tragically, of course, Clemente was lost in a plane crash, delivering aid to earthquake victims in Nicaragua, just a few months after his namesake won the 1972 Derby at Epsom. True, Roberto required the very devil of a ride from Lester Piggott, whose defection to runner-up Rheingold for a rematch at York that summer suggested that he too believed that no other jockey would have got him home. So Galbraith brought over Braulio Baeza to beat not only Rheingold, but also the supposedly invincible Brigadier Gerard. 9 years previously, Baeza had become the first Latin American jockey to win the Kentucky Derby on Chateauguay. Another Galbraith breach of ethnic barriers to elite competition. It was Chateauguay whose exercise rider got it into his head to equal the Pimlico track record when breezing 5 days before the Preakness. He still finished second, and then won the Belmont, so he should probably have won the Triple Crown. Regardless, Galbraith had now become the first man to win both the Kentucky Derby and the Epsom Original. Historic vindication, as such, for the record sum he had paid for the sire of Chateauguay, Swaps, as the linchpin of his vision for Derby Down.
I think his plan was defined by his passion more than anything else. And he had an undeniable confidence that things will just work out. So it was crazy money that he paid for Swaps. His business plan was not what we would anticipate in this day and age, because it was a different age. It was the age of the Whitneys and the Vanderbilts and the Firestones and big, prominent East Coast families and a few oil families and the like. So it was a different age where the value and the business was not going to be so much in this particular product of horses as much as it was in networking. And I think that's how he looked at it. If he could survive enough, the value was going to be in the contacts and the relationships he made. And that was true, and I refer to this in baseball as well.
This tract of the Bluegrass already had a long history. Originally surveyed by Daniel Boone and first used to raise thoroughbreds by a great character of the frontier era, Colonel E.R. Bradley. As Idle Hour Farm, it had everything from its own fire engines to a chapel to a railhead.
When E.R. Bradley came here out of the West, and he was a classic American story in his own right, he went West young man and loved horses and loved to bet on horses and raise horses and race horses. And he came to this area with the intent of producing what was the quintessential horse farm at the time. And he was a very classic gentleman, Irish Catholic, very proud and very devout to his religion. And yet he had this passion for gambling. He enjoyed his bourbon. He did start the racetrack in New Orleans called the Fairgrounds, which is still there today. He had more Derby entrants than anybody in history, and that probably will never be broken. He won the Kentucky Derby 4 times.
Galbraith bought a first parcel of Idle Hour after Bradley's death in 1946. And one of the accompanying boons was Gentry.
Olin Gentry was a character of classic proportions as well. Very much a Southerner, very much a gentleman, but he had his Southern values. I'll leave it that way. His mark is on the pedigrees that we still have here after so many generations. John Galbraith had a basic principle, and it's really reflected in almost everything he did, and that is you hire the best people you can, and then you let them do what they're hired for. But he was very knowledgeable about horses, I mean, right down to all the details. He was an excellent writer in his own right. But he also understood that he was not doing it day to day. That quality overrides his ego or any ego, and he needed to respect it. So Olin Gentry and he had a wonderful relationship. He really deferred to Olin quite a bit when it came to particularly the broodmares and matings, almost exclusively.
But it was Galbraith himself who conjured the big picture left field strategies. And the year before Chateauguay's Derby, he had brought over the dual arc winner, Rebo. No straightforward enterprise, evidently, with Federico Tezio's widow still smarting on behalf of Italy's wounded post-war pride.
And she was very reluctant to just have the Americans come in and throw a bunch of money at her horses and her husband's horses and walk away with the spoils of war. Grandfather understood that, and as grandfather would do, very cleverly, I think, said, look, don't sell your national treasure, but you can rent your national treasure. Lease it to me for a few years, and then he can come back if you really want him to come back. Now, a lot of people thought it was an insane price at the time, It was going to have to be. But again, the issue was quality there. If I heard Grandfather say it once, I heard him say it 1,000 times. It takes the same amount of money to raise a bad horse as it does a good horse. And he believed in quality.
In the event, Rebo's temperament proved such that no sane handler would attempt to repatriate him, he would rear up on his hind legs and chew the beam of his stall. At one point, they put up a special barn adjacent to his paddock, which had solid wood fencing, so that he did not have to be walked there. Rebo lived there for all of 2 minutes.
And then the groom said, "Mr. Gentry, that horse is either going to tear it down or kill himself." And so he was let out of his new, brand new barn stall and never to return again, and just stayed with the regular program. And the notion of him returning was just, quite frankly, too risky. And that is certainly the notion that Olin Gentry conveyed to all the hands that came to inspect him.
From his very first Derby Down crop, Rebo produced an extraordinary animal, Graustark.
When I was 14, Grandfather said, "Come on, we're going to fly down to Kentucky and we're going to go to Keeneland and we're going to watch this horse. And his name is Graustark." And the buzz at the racetrack, this is the race before the Bluegrass, was phenomenal. And I was like, you know, you could hear people, "Well, should we go see him? I can't wait to see him." And I had no idea who the him really was. But in fact, I went down, my hand in Grandfather's hand, to see Graustark. And I can remember my very first gaze at Graustark. And it was, whoa. He was very masculine, a unique color, a liver chestnut, totally dappled, very masculine, very much on his toes and bold. I can remember him exceedingly well. I can't say that about every horse I've ever seen, but that was an unforgettable image. And then the race itself was just as calm as could be, and that horse just was just plain faster than anything that he was running against. And his stride was awesome. If I'd have to point to any singular event that got me involved in horse racing, it was seeing Graustark at Keeneland.
And then, to complete the introduction of the young Phillips to the highs and lows of his ultimate vocation, Graustark broke his coffin bone on his next start. Besides Rebo, the other European phenomenon brought to Derby Down was Seabird. In each case, Galbraith was seeking classic blood.
And America, particularly in the 60s, began to focus on speed. And the 70s surely manifested that desire. And it was carried on, really, quite frankly, with our body types. Guys like Wayne Lucas became attracted to in the late 70s, early 80s, which is much more a quarter horse style of a conformation and look. And that wasn't what Grandfather really wanted. Grandfather, he thought that winning the Belmont was equally as fantastic as winning the Derby, and felt that Europe was the best repository of the genetics to accomplish that.
Seabird's son, Little Current, confirmed as much in 1974 as another Triple Crown winner, Monkey. After a luckless Kentucky Derby run that ultimately caused the safety limit to be reduced, he won both other legs by 7 lengths. But Roberto's sire, Hail to Reason, had already shown how bloodlines could transcend racing disciplines, giving Galbraith a second Kentucky Derby in 1967.
And they had called the National Guard out that day because there were some brutal social issues and riots and a lot of social unrest. And there was a threat at the time that a bomb was going to be placed in the grandstand of Churchill Downs and so on and so forth. In addition to that, what made it even stranger, more eerie, was the fact that it was a totally foggy day and you couldn't see virtually anything. So standing in the grandstand, you just saw shadows going by on the backside. When he actually came around the quarter pole, you didn't know what horse it was. And then out of the mist, it's Proud Clarion, and everybody's scratching their head. Who? Where's Damascus? And he went off at 32-1 and shocked everybody, so including ourselves.
Gradually, Galbraith and Gentry developed their own dynasties, sometimes planning matings specifically to pair a resulting filly with another Derby Down stallion. And the process became so organic that in 1985 alone, Roberto sired both Brian's Time, later a potent sire in Japan, and turf champion Sunshine Forever, out of Graustark Daughters of the Galbraith Foundation mare Golden Trail, and also Dynaformer, later an important sire himself, out of a granddaughter of Golden Trail, by Graustark's brother, His Majesty. For Galbraith's passion was not just the winner's circle, but the patient cycles of getting there.
It challenged him later in the 80s because it really almost created the death of Derby Dan. But it was a beautiful process.
By the time of Galbraith's death in 1988, the old school of home farm breeding, underpinned by purse money, was being outflanked by a market surge driven by global investors like the Mactoums and Coolmore. You could still seek sanctuary from soaring stallions fees in your own bloodlines, but rival farms were increasingly predicating their business plans on the commercial market. Phillips himself had by then renounced a legal career.
I went off to law school, practiced law for 8 years, became a partner in a law firm, and honestly wasn't a very good lawyer, to be truthful. And I've often said if I could have remembered my law like I mysteriously can remember pedigrees, I probably would have been on the Supreme Court, but I couldn't. And the fact of the matter is, I wasn't looking forward to getting up in the morning as much as I look forward to it now.
For the Graustark dazzle had never dimmed, and it ultimately fell to Phillips to supervise the farm's transition. A consultant had come in and concluded that the whole thing was crazy, and that the horses should be dispersed. While Phillips refused that surrender, he did recognise the need to dig in for a more sustainable model. Today, Derby Dan offers a roster of a dozen commercial stallions, alongside sundry other services.
We had 70 mares, and only four of which were not ours. Now, you know, we'll have 150 mares, 130 of which are not ours. So it's a different program now.
Soaring Softly, then, represented an important symbol as inaugural winner of the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Turf in 1999. She extended a family cultivated by the farm for generations, at a time when Phillips had lost not only his grandfather and uncle, but now also his father.
We run the gambit. We have 12 stallions now, and it's a commercial operation. But the commercial operation allows us to continue our participation in the industry, and for which I'm really blessed, you know. Soaring Softly was a real key horse at a watershed moment because my uncle had passed away in 95, my father had passed away in 98, my grandfather had passed away 10 years earlier than Soaring Softly. And it was just a signal, I think, to the family and really to the industry, hey, we're still here and we love it and we're going to go on with it.
But the filly who had truly branded the new regime was Memories of Silver, who in 1996 broke the track record in winning one of six Grade 1 Queen Elizabeth II Stakes trophies displayed in the old mansion at Derby Down. Besides anything else, it was a trademark farm pedigree by Roberto's son, Silver Hawk, out of a little current daughter of Java Moon, who was in turn by Graustark out of Golden Trail.
She was a wonderful, wonderful horse. And there's almost no words because she came along in a time that was so critical for our family. My father had just passed away. She had trained really well And she's beautiful. First of all, you got to understand, she's just beautiful. She just takes your breath away. Not a massive horse, not small either, but just so well put together, and such pretty lines and pretty face and such wonderful disposition.
When Memories of Silver tried her first stakes at Saratoga, after requiring four starts to break her maiden, Jerry Bailey was kindly released from a commitment by Elliot Walden, albeit in some perplexity.
About 2 weeks before the Lake George, Elliot Walden was at the gap at Oklahoma and Saratoga. Here comes Jerry Bailey on top of, in the morning, on top of Memories of Silver. He says to Elliot, "Watch this." And he goes out, does 5 furlongs and 57 and change. And Jimmy Toner, the trainer, who is a great friend and wonderful guy, he was going ballistic. And Jerry Bailey just comes by and just gives Elliot Walden a big smile.
After she won, Philip sat on the deck at Saratoga and called his mother. It was a memorable lift for the whole family. And it was on the day of his mother's funeral, 12 years later, that Memories of Silver delivered a grey filly by El Prado. Phillips thought how happy his mother would have been. She had always liked to put her $2 on a grey. And that was another multiple Grade 1 winner, Winter Memories. Between them, mother and daughter have qualified their family to produce a number of hugely lucrative sales, and so helped to keep the whole Derby Dan ship afloat.
I don't know how some people really do it, quite frankly, but for us, we don't have oil wells in the backyard, and I'm not faulting anybody that does. I wish I did, quite frankly. But it's got to be a sustainable operation, both the farm operation and the family horses. And that's sometimes challenging to do, but we started off with a great platform of great brood mares that grandfather accumulated 70 years ago, you know, and we've managed not to mess it up too badly. The fact of the matter is we are just stewards. So I plant trees here, and the staff will tell you, you know, I'm crazy about my trees, the shade of which I'll never experience. But somebody will, because E.R. Bradley did, because those that went before him took care of the land too. 67 years old, I'm still planting trees, and I'm still hoping that those pedigrees carry on, not only for decades, but for generations. And I love it. That is what my epitaph is. It is this ground and these horses.